This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is supported by Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Now your host, Rick Moore.
And thank you, everybody, for being with us today on a beautiful Sunday morning. Thanks especially to those 91.9 and Crozet in the Valleys 101.1 for being here with us today. Our guest today, Professor Bill? I've got Pratt written down here. Is that right? I never meet our guests before we start. I just kind of do my thing. I have Platt down here, and I immediately knew that was wrong. Typing skills 101. Professor Bill Pratt here from Piedmont Virginia Community College, assistant professor of business. He's also an author. I love the titles to these books, How to Keep Your Kid from Moving Back Home After College, as well as The Graduate's Guide to Life and Money. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, Rick. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. You were telling me earlier that you're getting ready to run a marathon.
That's correct, yes.
So I especially appreciate you being here rather than running, or what I would be doing is sleeping in.
I appreciate being here rather than running as well.
When's the Marathon Cup coming up?
It's early April.
Early April. Well, best wishes. Maybe we'll have you back on. You can tell us what it's like to run a marathon.
Maybe. Maybe I'll even be able to tell you how to complete one.
So thanks for being here again. Our guest today, Professor Bill Pratt from Piedmont Virginia Community College. He's an author. As well as vice president of the Money Professors, a financial education company. Tell me about the Money Professors, because that's really what we're doing today for the hours. We're going to be educating people and answering some questions on best ways to learn about personal finance.
Yeah, well, first, thanks for having me on, Rick. It's always fun to talk about money. I enjoy it. I actually started a company with two other professors at a college I used to teach for before I came here to Charlottesville. And we started writing books and doing some other consulting and so forth for organizations that were interested in financial literacy. And the three of us just have such a passion for helping people with personal finance and financial literacy, because we don't like to see people getting taken advantage of, and we want them to make the best with the money that they have.
Not getting taken advantage of. So what that makes me ask is that a noticeable problem when you talk about finance?
Yeah, you know, one of the problems is, if you think about when you buy anything, if you're buying a house, a car, or even a credit card, the people that are selling these things have specific training and skills, and it's something they do for a living. But when we buy them so seldom. You know, you buy a house maybe every 15 years, or a car every 5 years, or whatever the case might be. And so they understand the game that's being played, and we don't. And sometimes we spend way too much than we should, but we walk away happy thinking we got a good deal, when they know that there was a lot more room to negotiate.
Explain that a little bit.
Well, sure. Let's take an example of buying a car. When you go to buy a car, they like to use MSRP, which is a number, ironically, not established by their finance department. That number is created by their marketing department. So it's a completely fake number. It means nothing. If you get $5,000 or $25,000 off MSRP, it means we made up a fake number and you paid something that has no meaning to it. So you walk away maybe getting something $10,000 off MSRP. You're excited. You leave the lot thinking, ha-ha, I got such a great deal. And then they know that, wow, I can't believe they paid that much, but hey, good for us.
So that carries over into other things, because what little bit I do know about personal finance, which is why one of the reasons I invited you on today, so that I could learn for the hour, is that the advertising in terms of buying stocks and bonds, et cetera, is don't use that company because that company works off commission. Use this company because this company charges less, because we only charge per transaction. So we have a smaller personal investment in this, in terms of you know, and where your money goes. True or not true?
That is true. A friend of mine has a great saying. He says, we can turn worthless returns into valuable commissions, which certainly makes a lot of sense. But what you're really looking for, yes, is fees. There's been some studies, and I don't have them in front of me to quote them, but essentially there's some studies when it comes to investments that says, well, the first thing is just starting. Just doing something is the most important. But the second most important thing is the fees that you pay have a bigger indicator of what kind of return you're going to end up with over time. And certainly if you're going to earn, say, 10%, but they're charging you 2% every year, that's really going to eat into your total returns.
Again, our guest today, Professor Bill Pratt from Piedmont Virginia Community College, also an author, and works with a organization called the Money Professors. Tell me, Money Professors, do you travel around the country giving? I think I mentioned to you my vision is somebody on stage giving TED Talks about how you should best invest your money and things that you should learn about personal finance.
Yeah, we do. We talked at organizations, conferences, and individual colleges and universities. I've traveled to a handful of different colleges across the country, actually. For different, you know, events that they might be having or special sort of, you know, a week-long sort of personal finance initiative they might be launching on campus. And they'll bring one of us on campus to do maybe an hour talk or maybe a couple different hour-long or two-hour-long talks.
Do you think that, I have the image of college students a lot in that comment and one or two made in the last few moments. Is that where personal finance needs to start? Is that the group that is in more need of education than someone maybe in my age group?
I think that personal finance education could begin anywhere. The earlier, the better. You know, if you think about the fact that most students actually don't go to college, it's certainly much more important to get it started in the high schools. For me, we focused on college mostly because we were college professors, but also, especially at your four-year schools, students are borrowing so much money. And they're getting exposed to a lot of freedom for the first time, credit cards and so forth. And they just need that education to really understand how to not hurt themselves and kind of put themselves in a corner in their early 20s.
Again, Professor Bill Pratt with us today talking about personal finance. So, Professor Pratt, we live in a world of high debt. I think most people would agree with that. In the last generation, but certainly within the last two or three generations, family or personal debt has increased dramatically. Why is that? Where does that come from?
Well, you know, it started, a mentor of mine once said, the problem we have is that we spend money we don't have to buy things we don't need to impress people that we don't know. And I think that's so true. You know, we used to be much more conservative in our approach. You know, our business was our business, so to speak. And we've really, the invention of TV and so forth, we've become much more image-based society. You know, it's about looks and image and so forth. And so it's more important people feel to impress their neighbors, impress their coworkers and so forth. And, you know, if you could afford, let's say, a Ford Fusion, but you could qualify for a loan to get a BMW, well, how much more impressive will you look to your friends and coworkers and so forth if you drive up in a BMW? And so what happens is we know what we can actually afford to spend, but instead we keep stretching ourselves. We want to hit that next level of impressing other people and so forth, and we're not willing to wait till we save the money.
And this, did I hear you right, that this, much of this has come about from television?
Well, I'm just saying in general, yeah, we've become much more image-based. And then the more social media is more image-based, more immediate, look what's going on in my life. I mean, have you ever seen Facebook posts or tweets about, hey, you won't believe the amount of money I saved in my checking account this week, right? But you will see posts of, check out my new car, you know, pictures, look at my new apartment, look at this new gadget I bought, and so forth. So it's all about, no one wants to talk about, look how much money I saved by not going out today. But they are willing to post pictures and tweets and so forth about, look what I did consume, look what I purchased, look what fun thing I have.
11:08 here on the Wake Up Call. This is WNRN and the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. I'm Rick Moore. Our guest today, Bill Pratt, professor of business at Piedmont Virginia Community College, author, including the book, The Graduate's Guide to Life and Money. So where do you start when you give a talk through the Money Professors? When you start your semester at Piedmont, where do you begin in the conversation about teaching and learning about personal finance?
Really depends on the audience. If it's a college student audience, it really begins with understanding the purpose of college and how the decisions you make in college are going to affect your career. In terms of adult learners, it really depends on the situation. I like to spend time talking about debt and credit up front.
Well, then let's start there.
Okay, sure. The first thing to understand is how credit affects you, and that's certainly important. I think everyone's heard, you know, millions of commercials now about free credit report and free credit scores and so forth, but most people don't really understand what affects the credit score and what the importance of it is. And the first thing to understand is that credit and debt are two separate things. Credit is your ability to borrow and the rate that you can borrow. Debt is when you actually do the borrowing. So the credit side is more about what's your credit worthiness? Is a bank willing to lend you money? And then, like I said, debt is when you actually turn around and borrow.
But when you talk about your, so as you said, the free credit report, what purpose does that serve the individual for me to get a report that says I scored this number? If I receive it, am I supposed to do my happy dance? Am I supposed to focus more on how do I, you know, what is the next step after I have the numbers?
Well, I do think it's funny that you bring that up, because I always jokingly, I watch these commercials, you know, where the guy's singing the song, and because he knows his credit report, life would be better. And I keep thinking, they make it sound like looking at your credit report improves your score. All that that does is let you know what's going on in your life. Then, yeah, you have to take specific actions. And what you generally get, and there's some things that are changing now where some credit card companies are giving you scores. Generally, it's been you can only get your credit report, which is different. The report is what lists what's going on. Have you had late payments? How much debt do you have? And those type of things. The score is just a three-digit number. And the score generally you had to pay for through myfico.com. But you can get your reports for free through annualcreditreport.com. That's a government-mandated website that lets you get it for free. But what you do when you look at it is you say, first of all, is everything accurate? Because that's certainly important. And then if it does indicate that you might have a late payment or something like that, you need to really work towards making sure you don't miss any more payments and make your payments on time and pay down some debt.
I'll try not to get too personal in this. I don't want to share all my personal finance. But one issue that happened to me in spring of last year was I got my credit card rate was increased. And I called to ask why. And they said, because you missed a payment. No, I didn't. Well, it turns out that in the month of April, I had made two payments. One regular, and one was a hefty chunk after I got my tax report back that happened to fall the day before the May payment was due or whatever. And so I made two payments in one month. Right. And as far as they were concerned, I made zero payments the next month. And it was quite an effort to go through and convince them, you know, not to raise my rate because of that. It seems like the credit companies have all the power. Not that that's anything new to those who are listening. But how do you make changes? You know, you said look and check for the accuracy. What do you do if there are falsehoods in that report?
Well, you did it correctly. I mean, you have to go straight back to the creditor and try to negotiate with them. If you think about credit cards, there's a competition out there. And while they do hold the power, and there's only a handful of them, they each compete with each other. So you can always say, you know what? I'm going to take my Capital One and I'm going to move everything over to Citibank, for example. And you have some leverage there. But you're absolutely right. The burden, unfortunately, is on the consumer. So you have to be diligent, make sure everything's accurate. But you need to go back to the creditor. You can call them first if you want, see if they'll resolve it. But generally, everything, if it's a major, if it's important, has to be done in writing with kind of return receipt, certified mail. So you want to make sure they have record of it. You can also contact the credit bureau if there's an actual mistake. And then they have 30 days that they have to either, you know, investigate it to fix it or not. And if they can't figure it out in 30 days, they will change your credit report.
You talk about you have the power as a consumer to move your account from this bank to that bank. What about playing the game where this bank says, hey, move all your funds, you know, move your debt here, and we'll give you 0% charge for the next month? Can I do that? Go from one bank to the next for my 0% fee. And then when I get another letter in the mail saying, oh, bank number three would love to have your business, and we'll give you 0% if you move all your debt over here. Can you get away with that, actually?
You can, to a point. There's a couple things to think about. First of all, it's 0%, but they're going to charge you, say, a 3%, 4%, or 5% fee to move your money. So if it's a six-month deal at 0%, but you pay a 5% fee to move it, that's the equivalent of a 10% annual fee. So you want to make sure that you're getting a long enough period of time that it makes sense. Also, if you're opening up a new credit card in order to move your money over, then that's going to hurt your credit score a bit because you're continuing to open up new credit, and that's one of the things they look for. Because think of it from a lender standpoint. Wow, this person has to keep opening up a new credit card every 6 months. I wonder what's going on with them. I don't want to lend them any money. They're high risk. So that's going to end up lowering your credit score.
Professor Bill Pratt with us here on WNRN. You can call up with your question or comment about personal finance, 434-979-0919. Again, Assistant Professor of Business Bill Pratt with us, also an author, How to Keep Your Kid from Moving Back Home After College. Hang tight.
Support today for WNRN comes from
TNN Printing, serving Virginia since 1982. In addition to printing and copying, T&N specializes in construction document management, as well as dry mounting, binding, and mail services. T&N offers FSC-certified printing, an internationally recognized standard for production and consumption of forest products. T&N Printing can be reached at 434-971-8976 and t-nprinting.com.
The Stony Badger Tavern in Lynchburg, now officially smoke-free, serving all-American wings, burgers, crab cakes, and ribs, plus 24 beers on tap, including locals like Devil's Backbone. You can find the full menu at stonybadger.com.
Automated Office Systems, providing WNRN with personalized local copier and printer service and maintenance. Automated Office Systems is headquarters for all of your computer needs, including sales and service of desktops, laptops, and tablets. Automated Office Systems, 434-979-0790.
This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And thanks for being with us here on WNRN. A beautiful Sunday out there. Enjoy it while you can. So back to our guest, Professor Bill Pratt. Bill, we were talking about credit cards and moving your funds around and other things, you know, checking your credit score. Back to something you mentioned very early in the show and we didn't really delve into very much is approved versus afford in terms of what the bank says you can afford, or what you're approved to do for whether it's a credit card or a home purchase.
Yeah, absolutely. Remember, we started the show off talking about what caused us to get to where we were today in terms of a high debt society. And I really think that one of the big things is that most folks don't understand the difference between approved and afford. And so what happens is just because you're approved for a certain loan does not mean you can afford it. Most people say, well, this is how much car the bank says I can afford, or this is how much house the bank says I can afford. And that's really the wrong use of the word. It's really, this is how much the bank is willing to lend me. This is the amount of risk they're willing to take on me. But the bank doesn't know your other goals. So maybe you like to take two vacations a year, or you like to buy a new brand new car every 3 years, for example. Well, the bank's assuming if you're going to borrow the maximum amount of loan for that mortgage, you're giving some of that stuff up. So they're just going to assume, I guess they're not going to dine out much. I guess they're not going to buy a new car anytime soon, you know, and so forth, because you're taking out the maximum. So the key with personal finances, and really it all goes back to budgeting, I suppose, but is to kind of look at your own personal budget, however you want to define that, and say, how much am I willing to spend every month on a house, a car, whatever it is you're purchasing, and say, and where is that money coming from? You know, right now, maybe you dine out 4 days a week and you're saying, you know what, I'll dine out one day a week and I can afford now to take some of that extra money and put it towards this car purchase.
How many people actually keep a budget? Do you have an idea from your classroom talks or as the money professors, what percentage of people actually have a budget?
I don't have an exact percentage, but I think I've met both of those people. it's certainly not that common. I can tell you I don't keep a budget in the traditional sense either. I do think it's important starting out, whether you're starting out in a marriage or starting out after graduation or whatever, to create a basic budget. And the thing about a budget is it's actually a very simple concept. It's just, what do you have coming in and what do you have going out? And I've seen so many budget sheets, quote unquote, out there, and I look at them and my eyes glaze over, and I'm a finance guy. But essentially, all you're looking at is saying, what do I have to spend money on? So if you already have student loans, if you already have a car payment, you know you have to spend money on that. And then you say, what's left over? So what I like to do, this is to me the simplest method in the world, is my money goes into two different accounts. I have an account for all the bills, and then I have an account that I can spend. And so I never have to worry about accidentally spending money that was supposed to be earmarked towards a car payment or utility bill or whatever. And by keeping those two accounts separately, that's about all I do to budget anymore.
All right. We're going to try something. Hang tight. We're going to do this. And then this. And we're going to ask. Caller, are you on the line?
Yes. Good morning.
Good morning. You have a question, Brandon. I have. Do you have a question for Professor Pratt?
Well, it's more of a comment. By the time I got on the phone, and you all moved on a little bit, but it was talking about everybody, you know, the new things that they buy, and hey, look at my car, look at this, that, and the other. I really, you know, I got a 3-year-old and a 1-year-old, and I'm getting ready for college for them already. And I find that a lot of times is what's his comment or his perspective on people that invest more in college and they're really going to return just because they're going to a really great place and they can brag about that, and how that really just puts those people in a jeopardy financially when they get out of college because they've sunk it into the name versus what they're actually getting out of.
Brandon, that's a great question. Thanks for asking that. One of the things that I do, because I do a lot of talks to parents and so forth, and I say, you know, your kid may have got into this really good Ivy school and you never even looked to see if you could afford it. And now you're saying, I've got to do everything I can to get them there. And why? I would ask them why. And they say, well, because they got in. And I said, you know, funny story, I was walking by the Mercedes or the Ferrari dealership the other day and I got in. And they said, you know what? You can buy this Ferrari as long as you're willing to basically give up everything in your life. And I would say, they sound awesome and it would be very impressive. But I can't, quote unquote, afford a Ferrari. Doesn't mean I wouldn't necessarily have the money to be able to put towards it. And unfortunately, while we understand that when it comes to buying a car and even buying a house, most people don't look at college that way. And it's emotional. You know, and anytime you make an emotional decision over a financial decision, you tend to lose out. And who doesn't want to do everything they can for their kids? But you're absolutely right. You really need to make sure that it makes financial sense for the family. They can always go to graduate school later and go to a bigger name school with their own money if that's what they want to do.
Brandon, thanks so much for the call.
Yes, sir.
All right. Phone lines open if you have a question or a comment for Professor Bill Pratt. He's from Piedmont Virginia Community College, also an author, How to Keep Your Kid from Moving Back Home After College. So, Bill, we're talking with Brandon. That was his question about, you know, getting his kids on to college. So he had two kids, and we all know, or at least that's what I heard, we all know that from just general news stories that the cost of sending one child to college has become overwhelming. Even if you don't go to the Ivy school, but you go to the state school. Even that, by the time you do room and board, et cetera, for the average family, I'm guessing that that's more than can be fit into the regular budget.
I agree with you, absolutely. And it does make it difficult. One of the things that I recommend in general is that don't plan for the student side. Don't plan to borrow more money than you're going to make when you get out of college. So you need to know what kind of starting salary you're going to have, which means you need to know what kind of job you want, which means you need to know what kind of major to choose, which means then you can choose what kind of college you want to go to. And so one of the problems is we have a lot of expectations now of 18-year-olds. I get that. But generally, you don't want to borrow, say, $80,000 to get a degree in social work when you know that the starting salary is going to be $25,000. You're not going to be able to make it. So it's very important to make smart financial decisions. You know, there's options. Go to a two-year school and transfer over. You can start at a state school. Certainly, there's ways to pay for it along the way. There's some scholarships. There's work on campus that you can do in the meantime. And there's a lot of different options that a person wants to look at, both the parents and the student, to borrow as little as possible. Because one of the things most people don't understand is how much debt ends up taking away choices. You know, you might get a great degree from a great university. You want to do something maybe cause related, you know, like kind of think Doctors Without Borders or, you know, some kind of more charitable type of position, but you don't have that option anymore because you have $90,000 in student loans. And you don't want those, you don't want your debt to basically drive your career.
Professor Bill Pratt with us talking about personal finance, also the vice president of the Money Professors, the financial education company. So, Professor, when we talk about college, one of the book titles is How to Keep Your Kid from Moving Back Home After College. Give us a few points on that. Makes me laugh every time I read the title.
Sure. The simplified thing is I talk about the ABCs, align your career goals with your college choices, borrow as little as possible, and compare your student loans to your starting salary. And I think if you keep those in mind, you wouldn't have all those articles you see in the New York Times and Washington Post about the, you know, the again, the $100,000 creative studies kind of graduate, because if they were aligning those career goals and they were looking, comparing their costs, it wouldn't happen. But honestly, the key is to start out asking yourself kind of what I call the three W's, which is, what do you want to do? Where do you want to live? And who do you want to work for? And everybody, and the priority of those three W's changes. Maybe you're from Charlottesville, your whole family's here. This is the most important thing, is where you live. That's great. But then you need to consider what your career field is. Maybe scuba diving isn't going to be your career because of the location. So then you might have to make some adjustments. But when you start asking those three questions and you get to the point where you realize what companies offer the jobs that I'm looking for, you can start contacting those companies early and finding out, what are you looking for? What makes you a perfect candidate? Where do you like to hire graduates from? What degree programs do you like? And what organizations do you want me to get involved in while I'm in college in order to make sure I have the right leadership skills and speaking skills and so forth, so that you basically graduate as the ideal candidate?
434-979-0919. Question or a comment for Professor Bill Pratt. Professor, so you're giving me the three W's for how to keep your kid from moving back home after college, but I'm hearing that as though I'm the kid going to college, not as the parent. So what is the parent doing other than looking over your shoulder, you know, their daughter or son's shoulder, to make sure the three W's are being followed?
The real key is communication between the parent and child. And I almost hate to use the word child, because you can't say that, you know, they're 18, they're the young adult, I suppose. But between the parent and child, there has to be a lot of communication. I think that there's not realistic expectations. For example, say you know in the back of your mind you can afford $15,000 a year, and your child is looking at colleges they're going to cost $50,000 a year. If you're not communicating, you're setting yourself up for some failure, because the child's expectation is you're going to help out no matter what. And until you set those ground rules and say, look, let's talk realistically, it could even be getting them in contact with friends in your network as a parent to talk about different career fields. You know, what did you do? What do you wish you would have known when you got in? Is this what you started out as? Did you change careers? Why did you change? You know, what experiences did you have? Do you have internship opportunities? I know when I was in high school, I got involved in a program that allowed me to see what it was like to be an emergency room physician for a few different weeks, and that's why I ended up becoming an economist.
Yeah, I think that would send me the other direction as well. 434-979-0919 if you have a question or a comment like Brandon did for our guest, Bill Pratt. So, Professor Pratt, I want to talk for a minute about identity theft. and how that affects personal finance. It's been in the news, maybe not identity theft, but certainly credit card theft with Target and Neiman Marcus and several of the other issues, and whether or not it has come about that the person's identity has been stolen. It's certainly an option or a possibility from what's happened at Target, and certainly credit card information has been stolen. So I want you to talk about identity theft for a moment and how that falls into the personal finance conversation.
Sure. First of all, there is a distinction between identity theft and sort of credit card fraud or credit card stolen. Let's start with credit card. If your credit card's stolen or you think it's stolen and you notice a charge that shouldn't be there, what you can do is contact the credit card company and they'll basically reissue you the card and you have almost no responsibility. There is some limit of around $50, but most credit card companies won't even charge you that. If it's a debit card, on the other hand, the problem is the money's already out of your bank account. And if they use your PIN number, there is no real protection. In other words, you are fully liable when your PIN number's been stolen. And so you want to talk to the bank immediately about something like that and make sure you get a new debit card, a new PIN number, and so forth. So that's sort of the credit card side. And that's just a quick phone call, a tiny little bit of hassle, so to speak. Identity theft is a much bigger hassle. With identity theft, you're talking about somebody being able to go out and open new cards in your name, get out a loan in your name, maybe even buy car insurance in your name, which means if there's an accident, they're going to try to sue you. Consumer Reports actually did a study, and I think it was around $350 is what the average cost to a consumer is in dollars from identity theft. So it's not quite as bad as it might sound, but it's the time involved in trying to get everything straightened out. You know, imagine you find your dream house. You and your spouse find their dream house. You go out to buy it, and you know you've saved some money down. You know you've paid all your bills on time, and all of a sudden you have a 550 credit score because somebody opened up three credit cards and a bank loan and never paid them back. And now you're going to spend the next 3 to 5 months trying to get everything straightened out. And of course, your house is gone by then. You've lost the opportunity. So it's the time involved, which is why earlier we encouraged you to check your credit report to make sure there's no bad information.
11:30 here with our guest, Professor Bill Pratt, talking about personal finance. So back to the credit card versus the debit card. When you talk about how the money is using the debit card, which many people do, right? It's I don't know what the difference is in terms of percentage people purchasing with their debit card being swiped at the POS spot versus their credit card. But it sounds like if you're using your debit card, you should go online or somehow check daily almost to see if what purchases are on the card, because once it starts, if you don't check your credit card statement, but once a month when it shows up, you run a much greater risk of having some serious problems.
Yeah, I know most people don't even look at it once a month. They don't really pay that much attention to it. But we, with online banking, we are looking at our accounts much more often. I think maybe some people just look at the balance real quick, and it's important to kind of click through real briefly and make sure there's nothing that seems mysterious to you. But you're absolutely right. With a credit card, it's the credit card company's money that is being used immediately. With a debit card, it's your money that's being used immediately. So, for example, I don't use a debit card at gas pumps because I only use a credit card at gas pumps just for the extra protection. It is outdoors. It's a lot easier for someone to do something fraudulent with a pump. On an inside, if you hit the credit button, then what happens is you're not putting your PIN in and it's getting the same protection as like a Visa credit card. But if you do key your PIN, your 4-digit number, and it gets stolen, that's going to create some greater issues for you.
So even if I use my Citicorp debit card, if I use it in the credit card fashion, I'm protected.
Well, you're protected. The money still comes out of your account right away, but you're not liable for it, so it will go back in. The downside is how quickly will it go in? If you're an established 50-year-old that has good cash flow and, you know, a couple $100 comes out, it's not that big of a deal if it takes 5 days to get it back in there. If you're a 19-year-old or a 22-year-old just starting out and you only have $300 in there, you're down to zero. You can't make your car payment for those 5 days. That could cause a larger issue.
All right. Again, our guest today, Professor Bill Pratt from Piedmont Virginia Community College, also an established author, The Graduate's Guide to Life and Money.
Our members are joined by the following underwriters in their support of WNRN.
WillowTree Apps, creators of WNRN's apps for Android and iPhone. WillowTree is looking for developers to join their Charlottesville team. You can enjoy the perks of working for an award-winning mobile agency in a team environment. To learn more, it's willowtreeapps.com/jobs.
Boonesboro Shopping Center, Lynchburg's shopping destination with shops like Loft, Francesca's, Joseph A. Bank, Chico's, and Talbot's, plus local boutiques and fine dining. It's Boonesboro Shopping Center for gifts and your grocery list. You can find Boonesboro Shopping Center on Facebook for weekly specials and events.
Hi, I'm Ben Coe from the University of Virginia's Contemplative Sciences Center. On Friday, January 24th, at noon, you are invited to a talk with Sharon Salzberg entitled Real Happiness at Work. This event will be held on grounds at Now Hall Auditorium, Room 101. In this talk, we will explore a path to finding real happiness at work. Despite the many hours we tend to spend at work, the arena of our lives may not be a source of great fulfillment or meaning. Suitable for both new and experienced meditators, the talk will consist of a guided meditation and time for questions and answers. For more information and to register, visit uvacontemplation.org. I'm Ben Coe, making a community connection on WNRN.
Make your community connection with WNRN. Email connection at WNRN.org with your nonprofit event or organization's information. Independent Music Radio, WNRN.
This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And thank you for being here with us today. Personal finance with Professor Bill Pratt. Call us up with your question if you have one for Professor Pratt or want to make a comment on today's topics, 434-979-0919. Professor Pratt, we were talking about a couple things that all seem to tie together. People spend more money than they're actually getting, sort of this your pre-tax income versus your post-tax expenditures.
Yeah, one of the I say we, by the way, it's not more the one personality. That would be the other money professors in my organization. But we come up with a list of sort of what we call aha moments, which are the, you know, when something sort of clicks somewhere in your adulthood and you realize, oh, this makes so much sense. And for us, one of the aha moments was that we work in a pre-tax world, but we live and play and spend in a post-tax world. And so we make bad decisions all the time because we start thinking about how much money we make, not how much money we actually have available to spend. So, for example, say that toilet leaks. We use this example all the time. And you think, oh, I don't want to touch any of that stuff. I'll call a plumber. The plumber is $150. And you might think, oh, well, if I make, you know, well, let's say $140, if I make $20 an hour, man, that's 7 hours worth of work. But, oh, well, it's still better than me touching it. Even though you make $20 an hour, you only actually keep $15 an hour. And so now all of a sudden you're working like 9 to 10 hours worth of work to pay the plumber to come in. So what you could have fixed in maybe an hour and a half, you're now having to go to work for 10 hours because it's not about did it cost me $140, it's how much did I have to go earn to have $140 left over after taxes. And so everything we buy is much more expensive. A $200 iPod is actually about $300 worth of earnings. After taxes, you have $200 left, and that's how much you're able to spend.
How many people, when you have that part of the discussion, how many people in the audience have that, you see them light up going, aha?
I see a lot. Even the college students tend to see it. I don't think they see it as much because they're not in sort of that full-fledged tax bracket, and a lot of them don't have full-time incomes. But when we speak to our adult learners, whether it's faculty, staff at a college, or just, you know, group folks at a convention or whatever, you can see in the adult's eyes particularly that light, because we see so many things in terms of, oh, I make $50,000 a year, or I make, you know, $30 an hour, whatever it is, but it's not what you make. That has no meaning. It's almost like an MSRP, right? It's what do you have left over to spend is what we have to be looking at. And so when you start making decisions, you know, you go out to lunch and you spend $15. Well, you had to earn, say, $22 in order to spend $15 on lunch. And you start realizing everything's more expensive than it seems when I start looking at what I actually have available after taxes.
So the pre-tax versus the post-tax, do you find that changes people's expenditures, or are they just now going, Ah, I understand that now. But, oh, look, there's a new pair of shoes that I want.
I guess it depends. You know, the funny thing about personal finance is that it's not about numbers. It really isn't. It's about behavior. If it was about numbers, here, I could fix everyone's problem with a five-second call. It would be this: spend less than you earn. And then we'd be done, and no one would ever talk about personal finances again. We know we're supposed to spend less than we earn. Why don't we? Why can't we? Well, it's because it's a behavioral issue. Just like, you know, there's so many New Year's resolutions about, well, I'll eat less. Well, we know we're not supposed to eat as many calories or as much fat. Just because we know we're not supposed to doesn't mean we're not going to go do it. And so it is very behavioral. And so you're right. I mean, there's always a large percentage that's going to go out and do their thing. All we can do is simply explain so they have the most information available, and at least they're now making a more informed decision.
That was one of the information that I got from the money professors. Retrain your brain.
Yeah.
It makes it sound, I mean, oh, great, retrain your brain. And then there's three paragraphs, and now I'm done.
Yeah, that's all there is to it. Retrain your brain, read a couple paragraphs, and you'll be a different person from that point forward. It really is. We are trained to spend money. Think about this. If you're having a really bad day and you're feeling down, what do? You go shopping, you go buy something. But if you're having a really exciting day, you just got a new promotion or just something great happened in your life, what do? You get your friends together and you go out and spend money, right? And so let's say you're upset, you're crying, maybe a major loss in your life, what do? You go out and spend money, or other people spend money for you or on you. And so we are trained that no matter what your emotional state is, the answer is retail therapy, or the answer is, you know, retail celebration and go spend money. And we really need to retrain our brain and say, you know what? I'm feeling depressed, but you know what will make me feel really good this month? I'm going to, you know, pay off a credit card or pay down a credit card or put some extra money aside for my down payment on my car or my mortgage or so forth. That's certainly one of the ways to start retraining your brain, is just be aware we've been trained to spend no matter what.
Oh, well, you talk about that again, and I'm so often wrong, but when you pay your credit card off, when you have zero money, zero debt on your credit card, doesn't that work negatively against you in terms of a credit report?
No, you don't have to have debt. You need to have credit. You need to have debt available to you to have a good credit score. You don't necessarily have to be in debt. You do have to use the credit card once in a while. So, you know, you could once a month, you could fill up one tank of gas, go home and pay it off if you want. But the point is, they need to know that you have credit available and you've never missed a payment. In fact, if you're making payments, so you need to use it once in a while. But you can have a zero balance every month, and it shows that you've been responsible with your money.
So talk about good debt versus bad debt. Another phrase that I saw in the money professor's info.
Sure. First of all, before we talk about that, understand all debt is risky. Anytime you add debt to your life, you've added risk, right? So if you have a lot of debt, even if it's good debt, and then you lose your job, it's going to be hard to eat and pay your regular bills. If you have no debt and you lose your job, it's really easy to find a replacement job that pays very little, but you can pay your regular bills. But if you have these big, giant debt payments, you've added risk to your life. But you can have good debt. So as an example, if you could choose between working for the next 15 years to save up enough money to pay for college and then get a job that pays really well after college, or borrow a bit now, leverage that money, and then get a really good job because of your college education, that could be considered good debt if you finish your degree and you're responsible and you don't borrow too much. If you borrow money for a car because you need transportation, that could be good debt. But if you just decide because you want to justify that you need a $60,000 car, that's not good debt. That would be bad debt. So if the money is being borrowed in order to help you increase your income or increase value, that's good debt. If it's just going to decrease value or just be a drain on you, that would be bad debt.
Again, Professor Bill Pratt, he's assistant professor of business. Also an author, How to Keep Your Kid from Moving Back Home After College, as well as The Graduate's Guide to Life and Money. Call us up if you have a question or a comment, 434-979-0919. That's 434-979-0919. Our professor, we're talking about good debt versus bad debt. But we're also, so that leads me into investing. And you say that savings is not the same as investing.
That's correct. We use the words interchangeably. But when you start understanding what the purpose of savings is and what the purpose of investing is, it can keep you from getting in a lot of trouble. It can keep you from taking risk you shouldn't, and it can also help you take risk that you should. So you don't save for retirement, particularly if you're in your 20s or 30s, right? You invest for retirement. You don't, however, invest for college if your kid's already 18 years old. You would save for college. If they're 2 years old, you invest for college. So essentially, you have to start with what's your goal. If your goal with that money is to use it in less than 5 years, then you save for it. And saving is about protecting your principal. It's about protecting the money. I don't want this money to disappear. I need it. I need it very soon. So I want to protect it. So you use what we call savings vehicles, which could be a savings account. It could be a certificate of deposit at the bank or a short-term bond or something. If you're investing, meaning I don't need this money for several years, maybe it's, you know, my two-year-old, I want it for their college, or I want this money for retirement, or maybe in 10 years we're going to take this great vacation for our 50th anniversary. Well, that's a longer time away, in which case you could invest that money. And then you want to use investment vehicles, which would not be putting it in the bank. It would be maybe a stocks or long-term bonds or one of those type of investments. So once you know the difference between what your goal is with the money, then you can decide whether it's about protecting it or growing it. And again, investing is growing and saving is protection.
But retirement, which for many people, that's what investing is for, not strictly, but that's how we seem to envision it. Retirement has changed dramatically in the last generation or two. It's later in life. It's cost more money. You need to have more money, you know, I was going to say saved. You need to have more money on hand for retirement because you live longer, which means that for many people, there are greater health expenses because you are living longer. So how has that changed investment and saving?
It's changed a lot. You're absolutely right. I mean, if you remember, for instance, Social Security, right? Sort of one third of the stool, if you will. And Social Security was designed when it was designed that if you basically lived longer than you should, you'll have Social Security, which probably would last a couple years till you die. When I say should, you know, the average. But we continue to live longer, but Social Security really has not adjusted much. So it used to be that you could kind of live off Social Security, not great, but you could survive off of it, I suppose. We're really getting to the point where you really could not even survive off Social Security. That needs to be a supplement. It is called supplemental, right? So it's a supplement to your retirement. We used to have pension funds. So as long as you work somewhere forever, you retired, you got a gold watch, and let's say 60% of your income. So you now have a chunk of what you used to make anyway and Social Security. You were pretty set. But now we've gone away from pension funds. So it's really on your own now to be investing this money. So you're absolutely right. So you live longer, so the money doesn't last 5 years. The money might have to last you 20 or 25 years. So you're working for 40 years, and you have to put enough away to retire for the next 25. That puts a huge burden in terms of how much you need to invest.
I'm curious as to the age of those attending the personal finance. You talk about giving a lot of this to college students, but my vision now is of people in their 50s, late 40s to mid 60s, because of this change in our culture. How, you know, I was brought up to do this. I was brought up to invest and save for when I retired at 65 and it needed to last me 10 or 15 years. And now that's nowhere, that's not anywhere near enough funds to have. And what decisions or changes in your life do you make in your late 40s to mid 60s so that you can carry on until you turn 90?
It's an excellent point. And, you know, we while we give talks to, you know, different age groups and so forth, the college market's just been easier because I'm a professor. So that's the easiest group for me to get in touch with. But you're absolutely right. And there's all kinds of changes. You know, I said earlier that we spend money we don't have to buy things we don't need to impress people we don't know. And that still continues even as we get older. And there comes a point where you say, do I want this brand new $50,000, you know, SUV? Or do I want this maybe 6-year-old used SUV that'll cost me 15,000, and that gives me the other 35,000 or whatever math I just messed up, and put that money into a retirement fund, an IRA or my 401k or whatever the case might be. So it really comes down to decisions. You know, I've heard several times people say the largest purchase you'll probably ever make is your home. And it makes me laugh because no, the largest purchase you're ever going to make is the freedom to not have to go to work again, aka retirement. That's your largest purchase. And when you start looking at your retirement as a purchase, so if you do the math with a financial advisor and they say, well, you're going to need, you know, $2.2 million to retire comfortably based on our projections, then what you're saying is I'm purchasing a retirement for $2.2 million. I'm purchasing the right to not have to go to work again.
And most people are going to laugh at you because $2.2 million, you got to be kidding me. I don't come anywhere near that. I don't have anywhere near that left over on a monthly basis to set aside, whether it's savings or investment.
And most people don't. And certainly $2.2 million is intimidating. And that's one of the problems in the financial world is how, because, you know, I don't walk up to a college student and say, you need to worry about retirement. First of all, I don't even use the word retirement until like the last 2 weeks of the semester, because you can't tell a 22-year-old about the word retirement. They don't really care. They're like, is that Friday or Saturday? Because, you know, that's certainly, you know, that's all they worry about. But by the end of the semester, when they start seeing the big picture, they do care. So what we talk about is, especially for the younger folks, saying, okay, well, if you need, say, $1 million, which is that easily, I don't have the numbers offhand, but if you need $1 million, then it breaks down to, if you're investing in the stock market, that might only end up being something as simple as say $100 a month. And I'm making that number up, but just follow me. So if it's $100 a month, that's only about $50 a paycheck. But then when you understand that your boss might match that, that's only $25 a paycheck. And then you understand that because of the tax break, instead of giving up $25 a paycheck, you're giving up about $15 in spending money a paycheck. And so when you break it down that way, and again, those aren't the real numbers to get to $1 million, but I'm just using an example. When you realize you only have to give up a little bit of spending money in order to put back a bigger amount of money that your employer then matches, and then you let it grow if you invest it correctly, and pay very small fees, you can get to that big number, and it's in very tiny chunks. And most people can't see that big picture until they've kind of had the sort of the lesson plans around it.
Professor Bill Pratt with us today, talking about personal finance, 1150 here on WNRN's Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. Let me remind you that WNRN asks you to support local businesses and organizations that you hear supporting independent music radio here with us. Let them know that you recognize their important contribution to keeping independent music radio on the air. And we thank you for your support of us as well. Bill, you mentioned somewhere in this conversation about investing versus saving the 401k. What happens to your 401k that you've had at job A and you leave that and you haven't done anything with it? They continue to call you or send you a letter. Obviously, I'm not making this personal at all. And you haven't done anything with it yet. What's happening to that money in that account?
The money's still growing. It depends on where you put it, obviously. But let's just say you picked a normal S&P 500 kind of fund. You know, sort of an index type of fund.
Yeah, one of the ones that like uses that little green bar to take you places.
Exactly, yes, which is great, by the way, because I think that simpler is better. If investments get to the point they're so complicated they make no sense, it's probably a bad investment anyway. So what happens is, let's say you have it in one of those funds and you leave your workplace. What's happening is it's just still growing. I mean, there's no problems there. It could become a nightmare for either you or your heirs if something happened to you. So it's generally a good idea when you move employers to get the 401k from your previous employer and then roll it either into your new employer's 401k if they allow it, or roll it into an IRA. And you definitely need to talk to an advisor, because if you do it wrong, they'll consider it a cash disbursement. Then you get a big tax bill and it can be a nightmare. But if you use an advisor that helps you with the forms, and it's literally like a 20-minute process, then you don't have to worry about any of that. And you'll have the money where you can control it. You lose control in your old workplace. So say you had your money in a couple different funds and they're underperforming. You can't move that around normally because they're under your old employer and you don't work there. So again, by rolling it over, you get control of your money again.
All right. So only about 7 minutes left. I don't want to do these backwards, but the word control made me go to this. You have something listed as LIFE and SPEND, acronyms for many words. So life is the one you have listed first,
right.
But a control makes me go to spend. Spend, S-P-E-N-D, stands for save for emergencies, plan your purchases, establish goals for savings, never let others spend for you, which is the control that got me, mm-hmm. and don't forget non-monthly expenses. Can we do spend before life, or do we need
sure. to? No, yeah, absolutely. And spend, that was, we were just having fun because, you know, when people always talk about spending and it's not about what you save, it's what you spend. It's not about what you make, it's what you spend. So we thought it'd be fun to play on that word spend and say, well, how can you spend your way to financial success? And that's what we're talking about. Certainly saving for emergencies. You know, the funny part about emergencies is they're going to happen. Well, maybe that's not funny, but we know they're going to happen. And so we always act surprised, like my car broke. Well, it's a mechanical item, is it not? So of course it's going to break. So we know that we need to save for emergencies. You need to plan your purchases. Anyone who's gone to the grocery store without a list and you're hungry and you know that you dropped in for bread and milk and it was $75 later, you get home and you still don't have anything for an actual meal, right? Because you weren't planning your purchases. Establishing your goals goes back to that helps you determine whether you're going to save or invest. But also, for me, and I know for a lot of other people, if I'm going to sacrifice, meaning I'm not going to dine out this week or I'm not going to go buy that big $100 item, well, why? Well, because I shouldn't. That doesn't help. But if I know it's because, well, I'm not going to go buy that $100 item this week because instead I'm taking this really nice vacation because that was a goal that my wife and I had established, it's a lot easier to make that sacrifice. At the end, which is where you really want to focus on, never let others spend your money. Everybody is always happy to spend your money for you. If you have kids, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Kids are so happy to spend your money for you. But even your buddies are. Oh, man, you got that F-150. You should have added the blah, blah, blah. Well, you should have. Well, why didn't you come and pay for it then for me, right? So everybody is happy to spend your money for you, but you need to keep the control of that.
And when I was doing the reading under that from the money professors, we're also talking about how salespeople have their own needs and they're trying to get you to spend your money and things like that. We talked earlier about the folks doing the stock purchases and how the ones who work by commission need you to sell, spend more money, et cetera.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And a lot of the brokers who work by commission, they always have a great idea. And then 6 months later, they have a better idea and they make money every time you keep moving. And the way I look at it is, if your idea was that great, why are we moving it 6 months later? So certainly early in your career, there's the buy and hold philosophy. And I know a lot of people like to attack it because the stock market went way down a couple years ago, but look where we are today. So, and yeah, we're going to go down again, then we're going to go up again. And that's the nature of the stock market. The concept of long term is, where is it 30 years later? Don't worry about anything that happens during those 30 years. But if you need it 30 years from now, where's it going to be? And you don't need to be moving money around and so forth.
So we go to LIFE, and this has several things that seem similar to me. LIFE, acronym for listed expenses, impulse buying, forgotten bills, and emergencies. But the one that we haven't really touched on here is forgotten bills and how on spend it was, don't forget non-monthly expenses.
Right. And so what happened, what we were talking about is the LIFE acronym is saying, why is it that if people get trained or they read about it or they understand how to do a financial plan, why do they keep failing anyway? And it's because life happens, L-I-F-E. And so what we're talking about is, you know, a lot of people, they list their expenses, but they're too small. They say, well, I only spend $100 a month dining out, or I only spend $150 on groceries or something. And what happens is, it was a good try, but it turns out maybe you spend a lot more than that. So here you created a budget. You tried to follow the budget. You said, well, according to my budget, I can afford, let's say, a $300 car payment. But what happens is you underestimated how much your expenses really were. So that's certainly a problem. And then impulse buying is big, right? I mean, have you ever gone somewhere you didn't know a product existed, but by the time you saw the in the window, you saw the sale price, you could not leave the mall without it, right? That's an impulse buy. You didn't even know they made that little gadget until all of a sudden you saw it. So that's certainly important. Forgotten bills is a big one too. I don't know about you. I like to pay my car insurance every month if I can. Just makes my life a little easier. But if you're not that type of person, you pay every 6 months. If you forget and 6 months later you get this big bill for, say, $600 or $700, That's very difficult for a lot of people.
And you put it on your credit card.
Right. Yeah, there you go. And then we're back to that cycle, right? Exactly. And so that happens to a lot of people. So you want to remember, the forgotten bills will kill you. And here's a forgotten bill that I think is funny. Birthdays, as you learn, take place the same day every year. And so it's funny how, you know, a birthday comes up, like a spouse or someone important in your life, and all of a sudden you're like, oh, you know, it's $100 or $50 in gifts or whatever. I don't have that money. It's kind of like, well, their birthday doesn't change. So you know those things are coming up. You know, just like we know Christmas is December 25th, even though it surprises so many people every year. And so we want to start accounting for those things as we put money aside.
Professor Pratt, thank you so much for being here with us today. We didn't even get into relationships. 10 seconds, 15 seconds on relationships?
Certainly communication is key. Don't think that the other people in any relationship you're in, spouse, whatever, don't think they're thinking the same way you are. You need to talk about it to make sure you're not moving in different directions.
Yeah, that's an hour right there. Thank you so much. Will you come back on in the future?
I would love to. Thank you.
I appreciate that. Again, Professor Bill Pratt from Piedmont Virginia Community College, also an author, How to Keep Your Kid from Moving Back Home After College, and The Graduate's Guide to Life and Money. Also vice president at The Money Professors. You look them up on Google. See you next week, everybody. We'll have Jim Duncan, Matt Hodges here talking about the local economy through the picture of real estate. Thank you.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is supported by The Markets of Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at wakeupcall@wnrn.org. The Wake Up Call is produced by Brandon Wong and Max Cecilia Struther. Tune in next Sunday morning at 11 for The Wake Up Call, only on WNRN.